Hello, and welcome to New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Each week, we choose an interesting new book on some area of sports, and we interview the author. This week, my guest is University of Michigan Professor of Classical Studies, David Potter, and we are discussing his new book, The Victor's Crown, A History of Ancient Sport from Homer to Byzantium, published in November 2011 by Oxford University Press. Most of us have some bit of knowledge of the games of ancient Greece and Rome. We have a picture of the gladiator matches and the chariot races from films like Ben-Hur, Spartacus, and Gladiator. And our basic understanding of the ancient Olympics is refreshed every 4 years by the television hosts of the modern games. Not surprisingly, though, much of this conventional knowledge of ancient sports is inaccurate. For instance, as David Potter explains in his book and our interview, gladiators rarely fought to the death. Yes, they suffered terrible injuries and sometimes died as a result of those injuries, but gladiators were the professional athletes of their day. They drew broad followings of fans and plenty of money for their owners. So, for a Roman impresario to deliberately send one of his gladiators to the death would be like a current team owner sacrificing a star player, say like Robert Kraft putting Tom Brady on the football field without any equipment. Now don't be afraid, this is not the case of a professor and his dry facts snuffing out our long-held, colorful view of the past. David's book presents ancient sports as even more intriguing and compelling than our standard notions. To give an example, we learn that the chariot racers didn't need giant spikes sticking out of the wheels to make the races exciting. It was dangerous enough to have 12 teams of 6 horses each racing around an oval track. I was surprised by plenty of new discoveries while reading his book, and I think you'll learn a lot from our conversation. David offers the expertise of an established scholar, as well as the appreciation of a fan. So let's turn to the interview. On the line from Ann Arbor, my guest today is David Potter. David, welcome to New Books in Sports. Thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to talk to you this morning.
So to start, I'll ask you to give a bit of introduction of yourself. You've written histories of ancient Rome and the Roman emperors, but as you explain in the preface to your book, you've also had direct involvement with athletics at the University of Michigan, where you teach. So could you tell us about your interest in contemporary sports and ancient sports and what led you to write this particular book?
Yes. When I was in college, I was actually a student athlete. I may have been perhaps the worst wrestler in the NCAA at that point in time, but I enjoyed it very much, and it was an important part of my college life. When I came to Michigan, we had a course called Sport and Daily Life in the Ancient World, and I began to teach it shortly after I got here. And over the years, I've watched this course develop, and in the course of that, I've also gotten to be very closely connected at times with the Michigan Athletic Department. And in the course of my work with the Michigan Athletic Department, of course, I've also been on the advisory board for intercollegiate athletics, and so I was able to sit and watch how big-time athletics and big-time athletic organization actually works. What are their concerns? I was able to talk with coaches, and of course we've had some great coaches here at Michigan, like Lloyd Carr or Carol Hutchins, and be able to talk to them about what their concerns are, how they bring athletes along, what do they look for in a good athlete, and as I began to talk to them, I began to realize the very many points of contact there were between concerns nowadays and those that we can read about in the distant past. One of the great concerns that you have any time that you're going to be a coach is, have you picked the right person? Is this going to be the right mixture of personalities? And in one of the books that we talk about extensively in The Victor's Crown, is a work by a man named Philostratus in the early 3rd century. A large part of this is about how the coach figures out what makes a good recruit, who is going to work well with him. In the recent redesign of Michigan Stadium, we began to look at issues of how you organize seating and space within this structure, and it suddenly became very clear that these are very similar issues to ones that people were running into in the ancient world. And finally, of course, there's the issue of fair competition. How do you ensure it? Anytime that there's going to be a lot of money involved, that a lot of people are involved with something, that they're very excited about something, it's pretty much inevitable that somebody is going to try to cheat. Now, these are problems that go back to the very earliest moments of ancient sport, as they, of course, unfold in the NCAA or the NFL today.
So talking about a lot of money involved in sports and cheating in sports, I think there's something of this conventional understanding or a myth about the ancient Olympics in particular, that this was sport in a purer form. And it really wasn't the case, was it?
No, it wasn't. Sport in its pure form is first and foremost incredibly competitive. And that means that somebody is always going to try to get an angle, get ahead of their opponent. It was really the late 19th century which invented this notion of a time in the distant past when all athletes were amateurs. I mean, in the very earliest account we have of an athletic event, which is in the 23rd book of Homer's Iliad, there's an assumption that somebody's going to try to cheat. When we turn to Olympia, you know, of course, it's famous that the athletes there only received an olive crown at Olympia for their victory. When they got back to their home city, of course, they were heroes and received enormous amount of financial support and financial benefit for what they'd done. There was never really an amateur era in big-time sport.
And there were also we're getting ahead of ourselves, but with the Greeks and the Olympic Games, there were free agent athletes as well, athletes who would move from polis to polis, correct?
That's absolutely right. If you didn't like the management, as it were, in your home city, if you didn't like the government, you would move to another city, and you might be very well rewarded for doing so. There are a number of famous athletes in the early 5th century who moved to places where they're going to be better treated. It's just as they would do nowadays, if they can.
All right, so I want to ask some more introductory questions before we get into specifics of the book. And as you've already brought up, throughout the book, you point to parallels between ancient sports and contemporary sports, and we'll talk about more of these in the course of the interview. But I want to ask first about something you point out at the very beginning of the book. You remark that there have been only two periods in history when sports have been a prominent part of society and culture. Today and in the Mediterranean during the ancient and classical period. So why do you think that is? What is it about these two periods of history that has made sports so important?
There are a number of factors here. One of them is simply having the leisure time and the wealth to devote to entertainment, to sport. And the ancient world, especially in the Roman Empire, as sort of Roman power guaranteed peace within the central area of the empire, it was possible to support very elaborate athletic networks. I mean, one of the things that, of course, is true nowadays as well, in order for there to be large-scale athletic contests, you need to be able to devote substantial resources to infrastructure and organization. And now this was true of the Greek world, where people were willing to do this. They believed it was very important to them. It was true in the Roman Empire, where certainly the imperial government felt that athletics helped bind the empire together. It's something where you've got a great deal of buy-in at the local level. You've got a great deal of sort of fan interest. But people also had the leisure to do this. There was some extra money around. There were resources that you could devote to building very large stadia, to enhancing entertainment buildings of all sites, whether that be theaters or amphitheaters or circuses, and to paying athletes enormous amounts of money to participate in these things. And that is something, of course, that's only been true really since then in the 20th century.
So something else you discuss throughout the book, and you just mentioned it briefly, which is important to sports in both the ancient and contemporary context, is the involvement of fans. So could you explain the importance of fans in ancient sports?
The fans really drive ancient sport. There's a constant dialogue between what goes on the field and how the fans are going to react to it. Fans like their heroes to represent their own value system. They like to think that they're very tough, that they can endure hardship, which is, of course, a feature of everybody's life in the ancient world, a world without air conditioning, a world where you have to cook your own food on a fire. You start this notion of a hero or an athlete who can overcome great adversity is something that's very popular in the ancient world. Another thing, of course, that fans like is to see things become a little bit more dangerous. They like to see their sports develop. And one of the things that's characteristic of ancient sport is we tend to move towards events which become slightly more dangerous, a good deal more dangerous. The chariot racing at Olympia, for instance, which involves 48 chariots, is almost a sort of horse-drawn demolition derby by the end. The sport of pancration, which combines boxing and wrestling, very much like the ultimate fighting nowadays, is a composite sport, but it's a very, very dangerous sport. And that's clearly something that was developed because of fan interest in wondering, is the boxer tougher than the wrestler? Who's the better athlete? How can you tell? Well, you create a sport which combines both of those. In Roman chariot racing as well, although you would initially have races with four-horse chariots, we will see occasionally people racing six-horse chariots. It's going to be very much more dangerous. It's very hard to control the team that way. Or you would make a charioteer switch from his normal team of horses to another team of horses. Really raises the question in the fan's mind there, is it the horse or the driver that makes the difference? And we can see this throughout the ancient world, this desire of the fan not just to watch the same old thing time in and time out. They want to see something different. Just as nowadays, fans who go to a football game don't want to be watching a 1950s rushing attack.
Mm-hmm. So let's turn back to the Olympic Games. And so many people have some bits of knowledge about the ancient Olympics. And every 4 years when we have our Olympics, we get a new primer from the folks on NBC about the ancient Olympics. But can you give us a more educated view of when the Olympic Games began and the role that they had in Greek society and culture?
Yes, the Olympic Games are really surrounded in myth, both their beginning and their end. We have a traditional date for the foundation of the Olympics in 776 BC and a traditional date for the end of the Olympics in 393 AD. And both of those dates were actually invented. Because the Olympics were competing with other festivals, the people who sponsored them wanted to make people feel that they were much older, because in the ancient world, older is always better. So they created a history of the games that took them back 100 or more years before they were actually founded. In point of fact, the professional athletics in the ancient world really come into being as cities begin to develop in Greece between 600 and 500 BC. And the start dates for the other famous all-Greek contests, which are held at Isthmia in the northern Peloponnese and in Nemea, which isn't very far from there, or at Delphi, the home of the famous Delphic Oracle, are all found in the first half of the 6th century BC, between 600 and 500 BC. And the Olympic Games seem to be a little bit older than that, but not a great deal older than that. And they really, these festivals come about as a way for people from different cities to come together and actually to compete, to meet with each other on neutral ground. And in the 5th century, actually, as the Greeks are looking to face a invasion by the Persians, the sort of events that people see in 300 now, it was actually at Olympia that they came together, because that was a natural place for Greek cities, for Greeks to congregate. At the far end of this, it's believed that the games were put out of operation by a Christian emperor, Theodosius. In point of fact, we have texts from Olympia showing that the games were continuing well after the time of Theodosius, that there's actually a church that is built there in the 5th century that goes hand in hand with continuing athletic events. What happens in Olympia in the 5th century is actually they run out of money and the games come to an end then.
So in describing the games, you give a close-up picture of the Olympics of 476 BC. So by that time, how many events were there at Olympia? How many participating athletes, how many city-states sent sent athletes to the games?
Well, 476 was a great year because it's the first Olympics after the victory over Persia. And everybody who could came to the games that year. There would be people coming from hundreds of cities to watch really the most elite athletes that they could possibly see. Because Olympic events are all held on one day, all the boxing, wrestling, and pancration, the so-called combat events, would all be held on one day, there were really strict limitations on the number of people who would be allowed to compete. And people would come to Olympia in advance, and they'd practice before the eyes of the judges, and they'd be worried that they would be excluded, and many of them were. But you could only have 12 to 16 contestants in each of these combat events because you'd have to get through four rounds in one day. These are really endurance contests, very hard to do and very hard for athletes to actually survive. And some of the most famous bouts at Olympia actually end with the exhaustion of one of the two competitors. In addition to the boxing, wrestling, and pancration, there are a series of foot races. The Stadion race, which is a 200-yard sprint, a 400-yard dash, a long-distance race, and one of the odder races of all is a race in armor, where you have to put on your helmet and pick up a shield and put greaves on your legs, and you don't wear anything else because Greek athletics are always in the nude, and then run a long race, and it seems pretty clearly whacking people with your shield as you went. In addition to that, there would be the chariot races. There would be races for two-horse chariots and four-horse chariots. There would also be horse races. And then one of the odder events would be a race for mule carts. That was banned for being boring after a while.
So are all these events going on simultaneously then to fit them into one day?
Each type of event has its own day. Horse races are all on one day. The foot races and also the pentathlon are on another day, and the combat events are on the on the last day.
Okay. And so how many spectators would have been there in 476 BC, say?
Olympia is a very hard place to get to, but that didn't just deter people from taking a month or two off to go to Olympia. And it looks to us from the seating capacity, from what we can see, that there could be 20,000 people showing up or more. They'd go and they'd camp out on the site, which was a pretty uncomfortable place to be in August. It was famous for its flies. And you can imagine what it's like to have a campsite with 20,000 people for a week and a half. That's real devotion on the fans' part.
So it's more like a music festival that your students go to rather than the modern Olympics in terms of organization.
I think if we sort of thought of the Olympics is looking like something like Woodstock every 4 years without rain, we'd be there.
All right. Well, you mentioned athletes running in the nude, and of course, this is something my students always ask about: is why did Greek athletes compete naked?
The question of why Greek athletes were naked is a very hard one to answer. There are a variety of theories about this. But the thing that strikes me is that in Greek art, important people you look up to, are always portrayed in the nude. And we know that athletes originally weren't naked. In Homer, they're wearing loincloths. And Thucydides tells us that Greek athletics in the nude really began not too long before his own lifetime in the 5th century A.D. And I think this has got to do with the association in the Greek mind between nudity and importance. You have to see your whole hero, as it were. You know, it's not as if people otherwise in public life take their clothes off on a regular basis, but what we see in Greek art is very telling, that heroes are portrayed in the nude, that warriors in mythologic contests are often portrayed in the nude. And it seems to me that athletes are sort of bringing before you what you expect your hero to look like.
So something you discuss in depth is how the Greeks wrote about the games. So how did poets and chroniclers shape the Greek story of the Olympics?
Well, I think it's fair to say that the world's first sport writers were Greek poets.
Mm-hmm.
They had the ability of a Grantland Rice to really bring an enormous amount of verve and excitement to their description of the games. We have poets like Pindar who always compare athletes to mythological heroes. That's just part of the poem they would compose on people's victories. And the same with Bacchylides, whose poetry comes in this way. In the Homeric poems, again, it's the great heroes who compete. And Homer gives us an idea of what would be expected. He always tells us, that, for instance, that boxing is hard and painful and wrestling is painful. He gives us an idea of a chariot race, how you try to maneuver your chariot and push other people out of the way. In Pindar as well, we get a sense of the struggle of the athlete. It's really the sports writer as well who creates the popular image of the writer, of the athlete, then as now.
Yeah, and when I was reading in your section about Pindar in particular, and you mentioned Grantland Rice, I thought this is probably the clearest analogy of someone who is, it's that style of early 20th century myth building, creating the four horsemen in terms of their writing about sports.
Yes, that's absolutely the case. And athletes are very conscious of this being something they want done about themselves. They'll certainly be spreading stories. They have their own publicists, as it were. They seem, in some cases, to be their own publicists. There's a man by the name of Theagenes of Thasos, and is an immensely successful boxer with a very long career, who people will think of as being even more than human, as a hero. And it's interesting that in the Olympics of 476, he's also going to be running into Euthymus of Locris, who's a great wrestler, who seems to have been spreading stories about the fact that he was able to defeat sort of demons on his way to the games. Milo of Croton, the greatest wrestler of all time, is a six-time Olympic champion and lost in the finals of his seventh Olympiad, would dress up like Hercules. And he put on displays of strength for people to come and see why he was the greatest of all time. So the athlete and the writer can work together on this.
And the athletes were presented not just in odes, but they would also receive statues in their honor, correct, in their home city?
Yes, exactly. You would put up statues either at Olympia or your home city, preferably both, I think. These statues were very expensive items, as would be poem you would commission from a poet like Pindar. But you'd want, the point of this statue is not only to commemorate what you've done on this occasion for all time, but to project your image for other people so they can look at you and see, this is what you were. This is what a champion athlete looks like. This is how you should think of them. So these statues are also sort of animated so you can get a sense for the person.
In you talking, I remembered a line from Pindar, and I don't think it was in your book, but I remember reading it years ago, where he spoke about old athletes being thrown aside. Is that correct? Did he write something in that regard, kind of in a critical way, looking at the way cities celebrate their athletes and then cast them off?
No, that's absolutely right. And he also writes that way about the loser in an athletic contest. You can be an Olympic finalist, as Pindar points out to us, and if you don't win, you're nobody. You crawl home in disgrace, even though you're the second best person in the world.
So he was both celebrating these games, but he also took something of a skeptical view of them.
I think he did, yes. I mean, he understood the way the world worked, and he understood the cost to the athlete. He understood that not everybody is going to win. And what does that mean? What does that do for you?
So you have a section as well describing the training center for athletes, the gymnasium, we would pronounce it. And so what role did the gymnasium play in the life of a Greek city-state?
Well, the gymnasium is a very interesting institution because it really develops around education and boys' sports, and it's really quite separate from professional athletic training. Professional athletes might work out in the city gym, or they might have their own private training area. But it's for teenage boys to come together in the first instance. They learn how to be good sports, They learn how to work with their teammates. They have contests and who can be the most fit, the best trained. This is a social center where people are supposed to sort of model ideal behavior for each other, where you're supposed to learn teamwork, to learn citizenship. And it's interesting that the gymnasium develops as an institution of the Greek city actually a good deal later than the great festivals of the Olympic Games. The average Greek athlete is like the average athlete nowadays. It's somebody who would play in middle school and high school and maybe into their early 20s, but wouldn't really expect to go on into professional competition. But they feel it would help them become a better person as a result of having done it.
So you talked about some of the lessons that young athletes were taught. And once again, going back to something you brought up earlier in terms of when the British rediscovered or 19th century Europeans rediscovered athletics and they looked back to the Greeks as kind of this time of pure amateur athletics. And the British in particular attached virtues to sport. And foremost among these are fair play, sportsmanship, being a good loser. What kinds of virtues did the Greeks attach to being a good athlete?
It's interesting that the British reading of what went on in the gymnasium as an educational institution is actually a very good reading of what the Greeks thought you should do. That they thought that you should learn how to play hard. That you should learn how to be a good sport, that the victories that you won would reflect on your standing in the community as a whole. What was not understood in the 19th and early 20th centuries was that the sports of the gymnasium, while they might be the same, you might learn how to wrestle, you might learn something about pancration or boxing or foot races, that most of the people engaging in these sports weren't going to be professional athletes, and that there was a two-tier athletic system in the ancient world.
So is it evident that there was something of a tiered system among athletes or a class division?
There was a very clear class division. Sometimes professional athletes would work out in separate gyms or at separate times. They would have their own private trainers, whereas in Greek cities, the state would hire trainers. Not all of them are going to be high-class professional athletes. Professional athletes are trained usually by people with professional experience. They have doctors who know how to look after them. They have very carefully conditioned diets. In fact, non-athletes will often comment on the sort of sufferings of professional athletes, how they have to be in training all of the time. Whereas for the average person, you know, going down to the gym, working out, hanging out with your friends, this was a part of daily life, but very different from that of a professional athlete. I do suspect that as now, trainers would be on the lookout for potentially excellent athletes, people with special talents in the gymnasium, and then they would see whether or not they could be turned into professional athletes. But for that, there was a lot of money involved. Trainers don't have money to pay. They expect to be paid high fees. So most Greek athletes were actually people of quite substantial means so that they could be able to compete.
So looking at training, and you talked about nutrition, how did the training methods of the Greeks and their prescriptions for nutrition compare to what athletes do today?
Ancient Greek training techniques developed on the basis of an awful lot of empirical evidence, and it becomes quite clear that people did understand the relationship between diet and performance. Athletes were urged, for instance, to lay off the wine before any kind of contest. They ate low-fat diets. They often ate a very high-carb diet because it was very important in the contest at Olympia, for instance, where you've got to be able to compete three or four times in your event on the same day within a few hours to have a lot of explosive strength, which is what actually a high-carbohydrate diet will do. They will tend to eat a good deal more meat as well than the average person. They will tend to vary their diet according to their training regimes. It's really a good deal of actual physiological science that goes into athletics in this period.
So was training, were the training methods similar across the city-states, or did, say, Sparta have different training methods than Corinth?
Training methods, I think, are pretty universal. You look to the individual trainer who might have a special angle. I mean, the same way you might hire a football coach nowadays because they have a special offense or a special defense they're able to run, and you think you might be successful with that. But when it comes to training techniques, there were books that were widely circulated on how to train. There were people getting together and talking about it. There were no sort of great secrets. You might think that one technique would work better with a specific athlete, and I could well imagine the parents who thought that they had a son who would be able to compete at the international level would look to a trainer just as parents would look for a coach now who would make the best use of their child's talents. But no, there were no sort of secret Spartan ways of doing this or Corinthian ways of doing it.
Okay. Was there a most... or a more successful polis in terms of success at the games? Do you find that that one city seemed to do better over a course of period than another?
There are occasionally times where there will be a concentration of really great athletes in one city. And one of the earliest examples of this is the city of Croton in southern Italy, which produced the great Milo of Croton, but it also produced the athlete who was able to beat him in that seventh Olympiad. And there are a number of other famous athletes from that area. Later in the Roman Empire, we can see that certainly there was a really good gym in sort of northern Egypt training people who wanted to be pancratists. There are a lot of excellent athletes who come out of Egypt in the 2nd and 3rd centuries A.D. There's a city in southern Turkey called Aspendos, which puts wrestlers on its coins, actually, is advertising. I think it's the excellence of its the training facilities, its trainers at that point. But I think a lot of this just depends on being able to get a couple of good coaches together, and they attract the best athletes to themselves.
Well, I want to turn now to the Romans, and in making the transition in the book, you point out that the differences between the Greek and Roman understandings of sports are evident in the very words in Greek and Latin that they use to describe an athletic event. So could you talk about that difference just in the basic terms they used?
Yes. For the Greeks, an athletic event is an agon. It's a contest. For the Romans, it's either a ludus, a game, or a festival, or a munus, or a gift. And this reflects a very top-down Roman attitude towards entertainment, that whereas in the Greek world, the entertainer will be a citizen, or somebody who's immensely respected for that, a regular member of the community. In the Roman world, entertainers are always seen as servants. You would never, as a Roman aristocrat, think of sort of competing yourself as an athlete before the public. You might work out in your private gym, and certainly a lot of people did that, and they were fascinated by the possibility that they might be as good as the people they hired. But the actual entertainer, the actual athlete that you saw was always somebody who was seen as a servant.
So probably the major sport of the Romans was chariot racing. Can you talk about how chariot racing began and its prominence in Roman society?
Chariot racing in Rome is connected, actually, with the Circus Maximus, as the Circus Massimo now in Rome. It was an area where you could run 12 chariots abreast, the track would be 7 laps around the Circa Massima. So again, it was something of an endurance contest. But the way that the sport evolved was really, I think, shaped by the space that was actually available in Rome for it. And it seems to have begun very early. There's some records of chariot racing, suggestions of it going back into the earliest periods of Roman history. Our records of the development of the city of Rome show us that some permanent starting gates are being erected in the Circus Maximus as early as the 4th century B.C., well before there's any other kind of permanent buildings for sport, which shows us, I think, just how important this was. There are a few permanent seats erected on the side of the Circus Maximus for famous people so they could sit and watch the races. When the races were being held, the Romans would always build temporary wooden stands because it's a large part of the city and you don't want to take it out of use all the time, that is, until the imperial period when the marble circus was built. But in the Republic, people still needed that space for other things from time to time. But by the time of the Emperor Augustus in the late 1st century B.C., or his predecessor Julius Caesar, it had become a prestige project to build up the Circus Maximus as a gift. Again, this concept of the gift being central to Roman sports, from the leader to his people. And Augustus actually turned the central barrier of the Circus Maximus into something of a victory monument, commemorating his rise to power and defeat of opponents in sea battles along the way. It so happened that the god Neptune, who's the god of the sea, is also the god of horses, so it made a sort of obvious connection for him there. And Augustus first put in marble seats, and then later emperors like Trajan built up the whole area out of marble so that it would be a central place for the emperor to make contact with his subjects, and he'd be expected to go there and sit through the chariot races, listening to people as they would occasionally complain about things that were going on in the world around them. It was a place for the Roman people really to assemble, not just for fun, but occasionally as well to let the emperor know what was on their minds.
So are these, I was thinking of a professor I had when I was an undergraduate, and he taught in the classics department. He was also a Maoist. He proudly wore a Mao pin. And I remember he wrote an editorial in the school, in the university newspaper. It was right before the Super Bowl, and he was talking about modern sports, and in particular the Super Bowl, as the means by which the bourgeoisie kept the proletariat mollified. So do you have a, with that, and then they did make a connection to ancient sport. We see the same thing with the ancient Romans, he said. So thinking of games as a gift and talking about the importance of building stadia by the emperors, was that their aim, to basically keep the population placated?
There's a very famous line in a Roman poet who says, the Roman people used to be interested in wars and matters of state, and now all they care about is bread and circuses. And there's a fair amount of truth to that, that emperors realized, and people in government anywhere across the Roman Empire realized that they had to be seen to be doing something that the average person could benefit from. They had to provide subsidized grain, and they had to provide games that people would enjoy. So yes, it is absolutely a form of, I think a Roman would say, we're trying to bring social peace this way. It's a requirement of civic magistrates, it's a requirement of emperors to make sure that the games actually work for people, and if they don't work, they can expect to hear from it, to hear about it.
So I want to go back, and you had mentioned earlier the involvement of Julius Caesar in the building of Circus Maximus. And it was interesting. I was surprised to read that he was one of the most important figures in the history of sport in Rome. So could you talk about his role not only with chariot racing, but with gladiator matches?
Yes, Julius Caesar was one of the greats of impresarios. That's why he was such a good politician. He understood how to reach out to the Roman people. And he realized that a great way to show people what a nice guy he was, how he cared for their interests, was by providing good chariot races and providing the best gladiators. And it's interesting, Caesar put together, as early as the 60s, a group of more than 300 gladiators, and he was going to put on a display of these gladiators, and his political rivals banned him from doing this, which was, for Caesar, a great political success. See what I want to do for you, and they won't let me do it. But later on, he would also rent out his gladiators to other people, and he seems to have been taken a keen interest in his gladiators not being killed. We're told, in fact, that he would have his agents wandering around Italy, going to gladiatorial fights, and if they saw a good gladiator who had lost and might have been killed, they would step in and buy the guy off the sands. And Caesar's gladiators became very loyal to him. They acted as sort of, they could act as bodyguards for him or his friends when he was in Rome if he needed to. When he invaded Italy in 49, the first thing his political rivals did was arrest all of his gladiators because they thought they'd be a fifth column working for Caesar. It really undermines the picture of the gladiator that we get in shows like Spartacus as being a group of imprisoned slaves. These people were really, at least the ones who worked for Caesar, very well treated. They could move around freely in society. They knew that their chances of dying in the sand weren't all that great. I mean, it's a dangerous sport no matter how you do it, but Caesar made an effort to make it less dangerous if he could. After his victories in civil war, again, Caesar realized that he had a popular touch. He had to be willing to let people laugh at him. He had to be willing, to be seen to be at the games, enjoying himself. He would even allow people, to attack him from the stage. At the same time, he would also put on shows the like of which nobody had ever seen. He'd put on mock battles. He would try to go one better than anybody in the past. And he's not the only Roman politician who's good at this. His rival in the Civil War, Gnaeus Pompey, built the first stone theater in Rome, put on a major spectacle. Unfortunately for Pompey, his ear wasn't quite as good as Caesar's, and he put on a couple of events that were flops. And it was pretty clear that Caesar wasn't going to repeat that.
You brought up the mock battles that were staged, which involved gladiators. And something else I found interesting in your book, and it made perfect sense when you explained it, is that these gladiator matches, the reenactment of battles involving gladiators, had great patriotic meaning for the Romans. So this was not only a way to build up the prestige of a particular politician, it also served as kind of advancing, I don't know if we can call it Roman nationalism, but Roman patriotism.
Yes, I think the games did play a real role in the Roman sense of self. And the Romans saw themselves, of course, as a valiant people. And when they went to the games, they liked to see their virtues in front of them. They also liked to sort of be able to participate, even at a great distance, in the victories that their armies were winning in the provinces. And so, for instance, the Emperor Claudius would get a bunch of prisoners of war, and he'd have them fight out a battle for the Roman people to see so they could see what the conquest of Britain might look like. There are no movies to watch. You can't turn to the Internet and see some video there. There's no ancient YouTube. So the emperors had to choreograph all of this. They would also do it in an area that Caesar had first dug out by the Tiber, where you could watch mock naval battles. Sometimes you'd do them on historical themes so you could remember what the ancestors did to the Persians before you declared war on Persia again. It would also be the case, in a very grisly way, that you would bring captives in war before the Roman people and execute them. You might make them fight each other. You might throw them to the lions. But again, this is to give the Roman people a sense of who their enemies are. This is the one place where you would see them.
So you brought up the mock naval battles, and I know there's something of a debate as to whether these were actually staged in the Colosseum in Rome. What is the evidence or the current view on mock naval battles in the Colosseum?
There's a great deal of debate still about whether or not there were mock naval battles in the Colosseum. But the key point seems to be that the people who were actually there, the sources that we have, which are contemporary with the opening of the Colosseum, actually make it pretty clear that the naval events weren't in the Colosseum itself. They were across the river in the pond, which had been dug out by Caesar, later Augustus, for these mock naval battles. And one point which has caused some confusion is the fact that a land event was then staged in the same area because the area was boarded over after the naval battle for a land battle to be seen. And people had mistakenly thought that that was in the Colosseum. But it's pretty clear from the most contemporary sources that this was actually across the river. The only person who says that there were naval battles in the Colosseum was actually writing hundreds of years, more than 100 years after the event, and I think he got himself a bit confused. Another problem in the Colosseum is there's no way to fill it up and drain it. And those massive substructures that visitors to the Colosseum would see there now were all there when the building was built. I mean, there's no actual way to put a decent boat in the Colosseum.
All right, you mentioned Spartacus as one of the great gladiator movies, and the other great gladiator movie that you mentioned in your book is Gladiator. And so I want to ask, how historically accurate is Gladiator?
Gladiator is, I think, one of the great movies ever made, in part because the way it brings the audience really into the Colosseum, and you're there cheering for Maximus along with everybody else, which in that sense of sort of including the audience in the struggle of its hero is a wonderful evocation of the atmosphere of the Colosseum. Now, the things that go on there in the movie are great Hollywood stuff. You have the mock battle, and as the gladiators go in, somebody says, "We don't usually use gladiators for this, do we?" Well, that's one of the most accurate things they say in the movie. The duel that Maximus fights with the great champion gladiator, again, that's the kind of thing that would happen, but there wouldn't be anybody releasing cats at you while you're doing it. As I say, it's a great movie. It does catch the emotional aspects of the amphitheater, even if it doesn't do so with the events that were there.
And matches to the death were actually rare, correct?
They were very rare. Gladiators, highly trained professionals. They were often very popular figures, and people liked to see them fight again and again. Now, gladiators could die, obviously, because it's a dangerous sport. Medical care wasn't very good. You could be very badly injured. There was no sort of surgery of the sort that we have nowadays. There's no Tommy John surgery to get you back out on the amphitheater within a year if you've had problems with your shoulder. But most of the time, gladiators did not fight to the death. They fought to a determined, fixed conclusion, which could be first blood, or it could be the surrender of your opponent, or you could even fight to a draw. If the fans thought this was just so good, they could start yelling that they should both be let go, or they could both be declared winners. Now, people did fight in the amphitheater to the death, and those were condemned criminals, and that was a part of the judicial process, and they're very separate from gladiators. And Romans would keep that division between the real gladiator and the condemned prisoner very clearly separate in their own minds. One interesting discussion that we get of the difference in a letter written in the first century A.D., the author says, and nobody was there to see the skill of the gladiator. Nobody was protected by armor, any of the things that you would see in a normal gladiatorial bout. It was just bloodshed. And the audience likes that better than the real gladiators. And that's part and parcel, I think, of the way, you even see the strategy to protect gladiators, that if the audience is going to demand more dangerous events or want to see more dangerous events, using somebody besides the gladiators in those events, I think is probably a deliberate act. You could have fights to the death, but they would have to be specially sanctioned, and they seem to be very rare, certainly outside of Rome, and we only have them attested very occasionally in the second and third centuries.
And I was surprised to learn from your book that there were women gladiators.
Yes, women gladiators created a great deal of excitement in the Roman world. We don't absolutely know when they started fighting, but I suspect they started fighting in the decade or so after the assassination of Julius Caesar, if for no other reason than if Cicero could have called one woman he really disliked a gladiator, I'm sure he would have done so. It never seems to have occurred to him. But by the time of Augustus, clearly women were fighting occasionally as gladiators. We have a wonderful depiction of two women fighting on a relief that's right now in the British Museum, and they have mythological names. They're Amazon and Aquileia, and at the top of the thing it says they fought to a draw. In a moment in Petronius's famous novel Satyricon, people are complaining about, oh my God, this guy put on these terrible games, the gladiators were all awful, they were cowards, the audience insisted that they be flogged at the end of the last game, and notice that they insist they're going to be flogged, not killed. But I'm going to put on really good games. I'm going to have female gladiators and the whole thing. Part of the ideology of this has got to do with Roman interest in Roman mythology. They knew that women had fought in the past because they have heard of the Amazon. So part of what you do as sort of an ancient impresario is try to bring the mythological world alive, and that would mean women as gladiators. The Roman period also saw a great expansion of women in other sports as well. There are women wrestlers, there are women running in foot races in the Greek world, and so another aspect of Roman life is there's a good deal more equality for women in the Roman world than there had been in the Greek world. Women could own property, and there's a sort of sense that women can do what important people do, and interesting people do, and there's other opportunities for them in sports that just weren't there before.
So when talking about the film Gladiator, you said that one thing that impressed you was it gave you the sense of what it was like at the amphitheater during a Gladiator match. And I want to ask you, what would have an afternoon at the amphitheater or the Hippodrome been like, and how would it compare, say, to an afternoon at the Big House today?
Well, it would be a lot longer. You'd start first thing in the morning if you were going to the amphitheater. And you'd go, first of all, and watch wild beast hunts right up until about lunchtime. And then you would watch the execution of prisoners at lunch, and people would be coming and going the whole time, it seems. And then in the afternoon, you would see you would see gladiators fight. But you might really plan to take the whole day off and be in the Colosseum. And the same is true with chariot races. You'd go first thing in the morning. The big race is the first race, very often. We're told by the greatest of all charioteers, Diocles, that he won a number of the times in the first race after the procession. And they could have as many as 20 chariot races. And we think that these things, you know, would be about a half an hour to get to run the race and get the thing set up. And so you could be there for 10 to 12 hours.
And there was food, concessions, and everything then?
There are concession stands all around the place. We have people, you know, who say they're fruit sellers in the Circus Maximus. I think, you know, the sporting industry then as now certainly spawns its own world around the venue for people to come and to hang out, to argue about the event, to say, you know, should this guy really have won? Oh my God, how could this person have been so awful today? Go right back to the tavern at the end of the fight. You might see a gladiator who hangs out in the area, or a charioteer. They might go and meet their fans after the event at a local tavern. It really would stretch out into the community just in the same way as you see around any stadium in a city now, and a whole series of restaurants and bars for the fans.
So sticking with the connections between ancient sports and contemporary sports, I want to ask you, since as you said, you sat on the athletics advisory committee at the University of Michigan, and on the committee you likely discussed what is the larger purpose of sports? Why do we devote so much of our resources to athletics? So in your view, are sports today more like the contests of the Greeks, or more like the entertainments of the Romans?
I think that sports today are more like the entertainments of the Romans. We see them very much as a way of helping to build a community outside of the stadium. Then, as now, we see it as a way of building, of bringing people together. But we also feel what people take with them as they leave the stadium, and a sense of having been there with their friends, people of shared interests. Whenever you walk into Michigan Stadium, you watch this wonderful community coming together for 3 or 4 hours around the game. And that, I think, is very much in the spirit of Roman sports. We also, of course, have some of the negative sides of both Greek or Roman sport, something that we've always got to be very concerned with, which is, can we protect the safety of athletes? This is a major concern for us now. Can we protect the integrity of the sport? Can we make sure that we're looking to get, we keep the best interests of our athletes in mind. And I think in the Roman world as well, you would see there was a great deal of concern to make sure that you could actually get decent medical care for your gladiators. I mean, the most famous doctor in the ancient world, Galen, originally trained and got experience treating gladiators. He was very proud of the way that he was able to keep all of his people alive. With charioteers as well, we can see, you know, people taking a real interest in the development of those careers. Again, these are very dangerous sports, and people have to be careful of them. And we've also seen nowadays, as people are bigger, stronger, better conditioned, that without really being conscious of how it got that way, we can see that what goes on in a football field or in other venues has just gotten to be potentially a lot more dangerous for athletes, and we have to be careful about that.
So we're almost out of time. I want to ask you, which ancient event do you wish you could have seen?
If I had to pick one ancient event, I think it would probably be Milo of Croton winning his first Olympic championship, the first of six. I think that would be the first one I'd like to see. If I were to pick another event, I suppose it would be watching the great charioteer Diocles win his 1,000th race. Not unlike, you know, watching Derek Jeter pick up his 3,000th hit. When these guys started hitting their milestones, I think the fans, they would be electric in the stands than as it is now.
So Diocles, I remember reading something that Diocles is thought to be the wealthiest athlete in all of history, correct?
That's right. Diocles made an enormous fortune. He had a very long career, a career of more than 20 years, but he was making more than 1 million sesterces a year in the course of that career. He was wealthier than just about anybody in Rome at that time, except the emperor. But he was really good at it. I mean, his longevity is extraordinary. We don't have a professional athlete, again, who, like Diocles or Milo, could be at the top of their sport for more than 20 years. Those are just remarkable records.
Yeah, so you mentioned, so Milo competed in 7 Olympics as a wrestler?
Yep, 7 Olympics. Won 6 and lost the last one.
Well, so he would have been from ages when to when? Do you have record of that?
We don't really know what age he would have won the first one at, but probably he was around 20.
Yeah.
So he was at the height of his skills still at the in his mid-40s.
Wow. Well, I got to get to work then. All right. Well, I'll ask you to finish. What are you working on now?
Right now, I'm writing a biography of the Emperor Constantine. We're having the 1700th anniversary of his conversion before the Battle of the Milvian Bridge next October, and I hope that my Constantine will be out there for the anniversary.
All right. Well, very good. Well, I enjoyed this book very much. As I said with my questions, there was a lot. There was a lot I learned, and you know, as I said, we all have kind of bits of information about the ancient Olympics and of the gladiators, usually a skewed view from Hollywood that we get. So it was great fun to read what it's actually like. So thank you very much for coming on the program today, David.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed talking to you.
You've been listening to an interview with David Potter about his book, The Victor's Crown: A History of Ancient Sport from Homer to Byzantium, published in 2011 by Oxford University Press. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of recent publications in subjects from military history to popular music. If you like what you heard here, please subscribe to New Books in Sports at the iTunes Store and link to our page on Facebook. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thank you for listening, and enjoy your week.